My argument was about revenge, justice, and the protection of our homeland, our communities, our families. These were the same factors that motivated them. In other words, our interests were aligned. I skipped the part about America's moral obligation. Over the last two decades, they had witnessed too many broken American promises to hear me preach about morality. Near midnight, we excused ourselves and somehow managed to maneuver down the winding mountain road and make our way back north, up the Panjshir Valley to our base. Burnson and I checked the communications from HQS and the surrounding stations and bases. No major problems. I slept like a stone. After a dawn breakfast of hot tea and warm bread, Bert and I met with Amrullah. Together, along with Hamid and others, we piled into three Russian-made SUVs. We bounced for more than an hour south over the narrow track along the west bank of the river, through villages, to the northern lip of the Panjshir Valley. General Bismillah Khan greeted us warmly. He gave us a tour of the front lines. The scene was similar to a World War I battlefield on a clear autumn day, with soldiers on both sides taking a break. Trenches and bunkers stretched from east to west, both sides squared off for a battle that all knew would soon come. We could clearly see individual enemy soldiers within a few hundred yards, moving leisurely from place to place. With my binoculars, I surveyed their fortifications, which had been mostly destroyed, at least the structures above ground. Some of the tunnels and trenches and bunkers were still intact, according to Khan. In debriefing Amrullah and Bismillah Khan, I learned that these battle lines were porous. Visitors seeing family flowed back and forth, among them infiltrators and spies. Amrullah described to me their networks all along the front and all the way to Kabul. From an intelligence perspective, they had the place covered. Khan proudly described his army. He had more than 10,000 men under arms, and this included some armor and artillery. He described how he would attack, using company-size elements for maximum speed and maneuverability. The artillery would offer supporting fire, including some from the higher ground he controlled on the western flank. 2 days later, he directed a live-fire maneuver with integrated infantry and artillery in full view of the Taliban. Like him, it was impressive. Facing odds of 4 or maybe 5 to 1, however, he desperately needed our air power. After our meeting with Khan, we traveled eastward along the front toward Bagram Airfield. We stopped twice for tea with local militia commanders, who greeted us graciously. We sat on worn, dusty, beautiful carpets in bombed-out mud structures, comparing notes. They described their roles and responsibilities. They patiently answered my many questions about their capabilities, the enemy, and their political aspirations. Our Afghan allies described the enemy positions in sharp detail. They even knew the Taliban commanders by name and sometimes communicated with them. They routinely ran recon teams across the lines. These grizzled warriors, many illiterate, had a supreme command of their intelligence environment. They seemed casually confident of their abilities. After slipping past some journalists staked out on nearby rooftops, we made it to Bagram Airfield. Amrullah joked that journalists could pose more danger to us than the Taliban. I told him that was only half a joke. I could imagine explaining to Kofor and Director Tenet how, because of lax tradecraft, our team's photo appeared in some newspaper. Bagram was almost completely destroyed, except for the structure of the air control tower, which somehow was still standing. The bullet-pocked outer walls served as evidence of sniper fire. Shards of wood and concrete and glass covered the ground. Chunks of shrapnel littered the area around the tower. We climbed the metal stairs to the top floor. The windows, of course, were all gone. We peered to the south and watched the enemy. Amrullah described the U.S. bombing runs and how the enemy suffered. Our Afghan allies wanted to know why we did not bomb more. Why not bomb now? Clear skies and an obvious enemy, just hundreds of yards away, underscored their point. That night we slept on the floor of a warm, mud-walled house. The next morning, Bert returned to the Panjshir. We needed to communicate to CENTCOM. Accompanied by a couple of our men, Amrullah and I continued eastward to the farthest point along the front lines. We drove up a steep, narrow, winding, rocky track to a small, fortified lookout outpost, perhaps 1,000 feet above the valley. The view was spectacular. Looking back to the south and the west, I could see the northern half of the Shomali Plains and beyond, to the small mountain range between us and Kabul, only 30 miles away. We spent a couple of hours there, looking and talking. I asked Amrullah about ultimate victory. His answer?
You keep your promise, and we will be victorious. But even if you fail, we will keep fighting. We have no choice.
His mix of confidence and fatalism struck me hard. He was right. They had no choice. From my new perspective, neither did we. A few days later, I departed Afghanistan via fixed-wing turboprop from a dirt strip near the village of Charikar, snuggled in the foothills of the northwest corner of the Shomali Plain. This was the first fixed-wing aircraft departure or arrival in many years. The word spread, and by nightfall the value of the local currency had soared multifold. Amrullah later informed me of this, to underscore the growing confidence the Afghans had in our partnership. They all now understood that the Americans were coming. Even in battle-torn Afghanistan, the market responded. Fubar. A couple of days after my return, Director Tenet and I were in the White House Situation Room. President Bush was at the head of the table. He was accompanied by Vice President Cheney, National Security Advisor Rice, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Myers, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, and others. As usual, I was seated against the wall, next to General Wayne Downing. The principals provided their briefings to the president. They expressed frustration that the momentum seemed lost. Rumsfeld grumbled that he was unsure about who was in charge, despite assurances that DOD was waging the war. The previous month, in the same room, I had listened to Rumsfeld complain about having to execute a CIA strategy. For him, everything seemed to be a zero-sum calculation. On that previous occasion, Armitage had proclaimed the whole meeting FUBAR, fucked up beyond all recognition. There was heated debate about our reliance on our Afghan allies and the validity of our strategy. President Bush and Rice listened as the principal bounced a mix of questions, declarations, and opinions around the room. Rumsfeld had passed around a DOD intelligence assessment, severely discounting the chances of taking Kabul or Mazar-e-Sharif by winter. I did not know if Rumsfeld believed this, or just wanted to cover his political bets. If the assessment was correct, Rumsfeld could say, "I told you so." If incorrect, it would be forgotten while he claimed credit for the military success. Now, almost a month later, NSC principals were having the same kind of FUBAR discussion. Tenet finally interrupted, expressing confidence about our plan. Noting that I had just returned from Afghanistan, he invited me to speak. I provided an update, describing our intelligence networks and our growing success subverting Taliban commanders. I concluded, "If we deliver the air power, our Afghan allies will deliver the ground force. They will attack. We can win this." The president nodded. Vice President Cheney was impassive. Rumsfeld frowned. In this atmosphere of doubt, There was no mention of the consequences of victory, no discussion about our non-military obligations to our Afghan allies, no thought of how to win the peace. We were still focused on AQ and the possible next homeland attack. Unbeknownst to me, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and others had already instructed General Franks to prepare for the invasion of Iraq. When I returned to HQS, I told Kofor and Massey about the White House meeting. We had more confidence about our plan than our leaders downtown, except for the president, who appeared to never waver. Maybe he did in private, but I never saw any doubts, as I had with the others. Within 48 hours, on 9 November, Allied Afghan forces, accompanied by CIA teams Alpha and Bravo, and by U.S. Special Forces, captured Mazar-e-Sharif. The city's residents greeted our men with jubilation.